From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And what's next? That's the question on Capitol Hill today after the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act failed to get a vote in the House on Friday.
So let's take a look. Let's bring back our Here and Now political analyst, Paris Denard, the Republican. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello.
And Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. And Paris, how are you? Because President Trump at first blamed the Democrats, but after 7 years and a presidential campaign centered on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, your party, the Republican Party, could not get its own members to pass it. What happened?
You know, I think that it is a prime example of the main reason why the American people sent Donald Trump to be president of the United States to work with the Congress and figure out ways to get things done as a businessman. And what happened is you saw partisan gridlock at its finest. After 7 years, the Republicans, you know, did not coalesce around a bill that would have been able to pass the House and get past the caucus. And the Freedom Caucus held their ground about the things that they did not want on in that bill. And the Democrats failed to put partisanship aside and agree that, look, we're not looking at something that is fixed. Obamacare is broken, so we need everyone to come together to fix the problem.
Well, Jamal, would you see it that way?
Well, I think the reality is it was a bad bill. Nobody liked it. It was poorly put together. It was poorly sold. Democrats stood fast, and the American people stood up in one of the most amazing displays of citizenship we've seen, frankly, since the Tea Party, and in many ways bigger than the Tea Party when you think about the Women's March and the millions of people who were on the streets. So I think the American people really said that they were not happy with the bill that was on the table, and they want more health care, not less.
Well, it had a 17% approval rating, according to a poll. But Paris, as you look back at it, whose fault is it? Is it the Freedom Caucus, the sort of very conservative Republicans in the House who didn't want that bill? Is it the moderate Republicans who didn't stick with the president on it? Is it the president himself who spent a lot less time pushing that bill than President Obama did with the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, look, I think there's enough blame to go around. I think that at the end of the day, the people want it. They want care, not just coverage, but actual affordable care. And so what we have to do moving forward, as this is a process, is put together a bill that does the things that we know the American people want and that a lot, if not the majority, if not all the Republicans want. Protect Medicare and Medicaid, make sure that the people that need the care that have pre-existing conditions are covered, as well as make sure that if you are 26, you stay on the plan. But it's a difficult thing to do. It's not easy.
But, right.
but in terms of blame, you have to look toward at the Congress and say, you all are the ones that can make this happen. Republicans, Democrats, come together and actually do something.
You're right. It's not easy at all, Paris. And that's what President Obama knew. And because the real confounding part of what you just outlined is you laid out the other part that people are looking for, which is the Freedom Caucus members who want less government interference and they want a cheaper health care plan so it costs less money. You can't eat chocolate every day, not work out, and not get fat. The reality is, at some point, you've got to pay the piper. We're either going to have more government intrusion, higher taxes, or you're going to end up with less care. There aren't any other ways to fix this problem.
Well, Paris, I have to ask you, because you know you've been on several times, and you have been a staunch defender of now President Trump. Aren't you at all concerned that all the reports were indicating that he wasn't as invested in this? He didn't seem to understand the bill. It seemed as if he thought you spoke of him as a great salesman and negotiator, but we're getting reports that he was threatening lawmakers and thought that's how you did it. Pennsylvania Congressman Charlie Dent, the moderate Republican, wouldn't deny the reports yesterday that during those heated sessions at the White House, Trump accused Dent of destroying the Republican Party by not getting on board, using language like I'm going to go after you. Aren't you worried that this president didn't seem to understand how it works?
I think the president first of all, he's put together under Rick Dearborn an excellent Legislative Affairs team. He understands how it works. You can call it the Johnson treatment or the Trump treatment, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I think when you look at what President Obama did, he really, if you go back and reflect upon how that bill was shoved down the throats of the American people and passed without any, that bill was driven by Speaker Pelosi. She really owned that bill and made it get to the floor and made it pass. Now, President Trump, on the other hand, relied on his partners on the Hill, Speaker Ryan and the GOP leadership, and they fell short. So I think he understood the process, but the first bill out of the gate was relying more on the Hill for them to drive the agenda.
Well, let's talk about Speaker Ryan for a minute, because people have questioned whether he'll be able to stay in power there after this defeat. On Saturday morning, Trump tweeted that people should watch Fox News host Jeanine Pirro's show that evening. Didn't say anything else. He just said everybody should watch Jeanine Pirro's show. And she made this statement at the top of her show.
Paul Ryan needs to step down as Speaker of the House. The reason? He failed to deliver the votes on his health care bill.
So then people were wondering, is that the message that President Trump wanted to get out there? And on Fox News Sunday, host Chris Wallace asked Reince Priebus, the chief of staff at the White House, about the timing of that and whether the president wants Ryan to resign.
I think it was more coincidental, Chris.
Come on.
I did not talk to the president about the tweet. I'm just telling you the truth. There was no pre-planning here. The president,
why would he out say watch her and then that's the first thing?
Because
out of
he
her
loves
mind.
Judge Jeanine and he wanted to do Judge Jeanine a favor.
Now I hear a laugh on the other end of the line. I assume Jamal that was you.
It was more like a snort.
It was like a cackle.
It was more like
Jamal's cackle.
They lie about so much.
Whoa.
And to lie about something that is so easily I can't say it's disproven, but it's clearly it's just not probable that the president of the United States randomly pointing out a show that he's never pointed out for people to watch before on the day that this woman went after Speaker Ryan. And if perhaps they hadn't been telling stories about Barack Obama, wiretapping Trump Tower and all the other things that we've heard about in the last few weeks, maybe we could give him a gimme. But this is just a pattern that we can't sustain.
Okay. Well, I heard your woo, and there was a little bit of a shade thrown at you there. Paris, obviously, you don't think the president has lied. There were some reports that, in fact, he had intel from the show that they were going to say something positive about the Russian investigations, and that's maybe what he was pointing people to. But what about this idea that this president has not been very, well, has said things that can be challenged, has said that he was wiretapped based on nothing and sent all the energy into down that rabbit hole when people should have been talking about his health care act. Are you concerned about that?
I think we just have to be fair. You know, in fairness, President Obama said you could keep your doctor. He said that premiums would not go up. I mean, so these are things that were said and things that were proven to be not true. And I think with President Trump, you have someone who is who loves the media, who consumes the media, and he says things that his team around him says, this is what the president believes. Now, what we have to do is allow the investigations to go forth and see what happens. Because as it relates to the surveillance of Trump administration or then Trump transition people or officials, it seems as if there could be some truth to that based upon this recent intelligence.
It was incidental. But it was incidental. It was gathered doing other intelligence, which always happens.
But on merit, what you're saying is even incidental. There were people in the Obama administration that were surveilling people in the Trump administration, the Trump transition, which proves which leads to believe that there is truth to what the president was saying. This is the president we have to get used to. He's not like any other candidate we've ever had who's turned president. So he's going to say things. He's going to do things. And you know what? He's probably watching or listening to NPR right now because he calls me his defender. So maybe he's a big fan of Jeremy and Robin. I hope he's listening.
Maybe. And if he is, please come on the show. He hasn't done an interview with NPR yet. Jamal, while all this has been going on, all these things we've been talking about, and especially the health care bill, there's also been the confirmation hearings for Neil Gorsuch, and the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats should filibuster that nominee. This morning, Democrats won a one-week delay on a committee vote on his nomination. What do you think the strategy ought to be for the Democrats here on this? Because it's dangerous if the Republicans change the rules and make it so you only need 51 to get a Supreme Court nominee through.
If the Republicans want to change the rules, they can do that any day of the week they choose. What the American people want from Democrats is courage and vision. Stand up for the things that Democrats believe in and have a vision for the future of this country that affects working people and buys them into the process. And what Democrats can't do is be worried about all the Washington gamesmanship. So if filibustering Gorsuch is what Democrats think is important and the right thing to do because he would be the most conservative nominee we've seen, then filibuster Gorsuch
Jamal,
and deal with the consequences.
In just the minute we have, Paris is right. There are parts of Obamacare which are broken. The Democrats need the Republicans to help them fix it. Don't they have to compromise and give a little to do that?
Donald Trump lost the majority of the voters in this country. If he wants to be president of all of us, not just the president of the people who voted for him, he should reach out to the Democratic Party and find ways to work with them. It is not incumbent upon the minority to fix this when they control the Senate, the House, and the White House. They've got to figure out. They own it. The president owns it. He's got to figure out how to fix it, not the Democrats.
I would just, real quick, the Senate Republicans did not filibuster Justice Kagan or Justice Sonia Sotomayor. So they are going down a very dangerous precedent by doing this. Put partisanship aside and do the right thing. Confirm the justice.
Although they didn't give a hearing to Merrick Garland, people would point out. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Great to have you guys back. Thanks so much.
Good to be here. Thank you.
One of Vladimir Putin's leading critics in Russia was sentenced to 15 days in jail today. Alexei Navalny was one of hundreds of people detained in those anti-government protests across Russia yesterday, protests he helped launch with a wildly popular video about corruption. He'd recently announced his bid for the presidency. He was grabbed by police while walking to a rally in Moscow. He wanted to join the biggest show of defiance since the 2011-2012 anti-government protests. Now, the Kremlin dismissed the protesters yesterday as merely groups of westernized elites, but there were big crowds in areas that have supported the president in the past. David Filipov is Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. He joins us from Moscow on Skype. And David, first of all, just fill out the story of Alexei Navalny. Who is he?
Okay, so he's somebody who came of age politically in 2011, 2012, where people went out in these massive demonstrations following parliamentary elections that they thought were fraudulent. He's younger than a lot of the old westernizing reformers from the 90s, and he's not tainted with the sense of failure and corruption that that era now has. He ran for mayor, got 30% of the vote, but lost. And the authorities here have done a very good job of marginalizing him. They charged him in a fraud case that was most likely politically motivated. That gave him a conviction. It's a suspended sentence, but it also means legally he's banned from running for president. And he doesn't get on TV. And whenever he does come into the news, the Kremlin official people avoid talking about him altogether. They don't mention his name. They'll say the issue or the organizer, or the perpetrators. They never mention the name Navalny.
What about this video we mentioned that he made showing corruption? We hear that went wild on social media.
It did. It's a 50-minute long, very well-explained, very professionally done video in which he goes step by step how he figured out and how Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev allegedly used all kinds of bribery and kickback schemes to assemble this empire of luxury yachts, lavish estates, and vineyards. And the video and the report were completely ignored. Nobody even bothered dismissing it. They just ignored it. But millions of people watched it online. It resonates because everyone here, if you talk to them privately, will say, look, we know that our leaders are thieving. We know the country is way too wealthy for us to be living so bad. And we know that that's what's happening. And here he was giving it pictures and showing how it's done and showing what they have. And it's very convincing.
So take us through the protest part of this. How did the protest happen? And then, you know, what was the reaction when he was arrested?
In Russia, there is freedom of assembly. It's in the Constitution. You have to apply for a permit, and authorities can give you the permit or not. And when they don't, which is usually, they have some sort of reason. Oh, there's repairs that day. Do it another day. Or they'll say, do the protest someplace out in the middle of nowhere where no one will come. So legally, they offered him a different place. And he said, no, I want to do it here. I'm going to do it here. The whole point of the Kremlin not putting it on TV, not, you know, telling people not to come, banning it, is because they wanted people to feel like they were risking something if they came out. And the reason people came out was they were like, you can't just get rid of me like that. I'm going to just show up just to show up.
Mm. Well, they had children with them. And then Navalny was grabbed. We saw a crowd surrounding the bus as he was taken away and others dragged away. I mean, the pictures are pretty stunning. People, their faces down on the sidewalk being dragged away. He posted a selfie on Twitter from the courtroom this morning saying a time will come when we'll put them on trial as well, and that time it will be fair. He has been jailed for 15 days, but he has a public face. Does that mean he's going to be better off or worse off than the hundreds of others detained who don't have public names?
Well, first of all, let's consider the fact that these guys are tweeting and sending selfies from courtrooms. That demonstration, there was this very rough part in the middle where the police were clearing out the protesters. But around that, there were 25,000 people. And it was almost like a picnic. The police were there. People were doing selfies, taking pictures of the police, videos of the trucks coming and going, videos of people getting arrested, standing there and watching it like a spectator sport. And that's a really important thing in regard to your question, because right now, the way that the Kremlin can play that is that it was a big picnic, big party. Everyone came out. They blew off steam. And, you know, that's there's nothing else to see here. They don't want to make Navalny into the face of this protest. They don't want him to be a face at all. They would prefer if he were just some anonymous troublemaker who issues reports nobody watches.
So what happens now? 15 days in jail for Navalny. What about the other people who were arrested, maybe not as high profile as he is? And, you know, we're reading of opponents of Putin showing up poisoned. So what's the concern for Navalny?
If the Kremlin really does order, you know, hits of its opponents, which I don't think it does, but if it did, it'll probably send bodyguards so that nothing happens to him. This guy has to live, is my guess. What happens next is he has to go back to being an obscure guy that nobody pays attention to from the point of the Kremlin. From the point of new Navalny, he has to turn this into something that will force them to let him run. You know, he has too much support to keep him off the ballot. I think both of those things are too much to ask for either side. The Kremlin's never going to make him go away, and he's never going to get, you know, allowed into these next elections. It's too sort of a rock and a hard rock. Mm.
A rock and a harder rock. Listen, just very briefly, the Kremlin positions this as, you know, the protesters as westernized urban elites, that the bulk of the country is for them. Do you see that shifting, or is that true? Is that the divide in Russia?
What I saw yesterday was a lot of people who were angry about their own personal thing. I'm getting paid 40,000 rubles a month. I want to be paid 70, and the corrupt leaders aren't letting that happen. I'm not getting my pension on time. You know, there might have been a couple of westernized elites too, but it just looked like a cross-section of Moscow where I was. It's great to try to cast Navalny's people as, you know, Western elites, especially since Navalny did go to Yale. Unfortunately, for them, that's not really true. Anybody who's got a gripe in Russia is angry about corruption. Everybody knows it happens. And the people who have a gripe in Russia are 95% of them.
David Filipov, Moscow Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
New Jersey's criminal justice system is going through a seismic shift. The state got rid of cash bail for most defendants on January 1st. That means most nonviolent offenders won't wait around in a jail cell because they can't post bail. Instead, they have a good chance of being released until their trial. Joe Hernandez of Here Now contributor WHYY reports.
In January and February, the first 2 months after New Jersey all but eliminated cash bail, the state's jail population dropped by 10%. Judge Glenn Grant, the acting administrative director of the courts, says the new approach is working well so far.
As with any rollout of a new system, there are minor tweaks and adjustments. But overall, I think the system has worked as intended.
And it was intended to do two things: keep in jail people who pose a danger to society or who might flee to avoid trial, and let out low-level offenders. Judge Grant says cash bail was meant to address these issues. For example, you could demand higher bail for higher-risk defendants, but it did that in an indirect and arbitrary way.
Now we're no longer arguing about that number. Now we're engaging in an honest conversation as to this individual is a serious risk, and we should pretrial detain that individual, or that person should be released.
A couple years ago, a study found that 12% of inmates in New Jersey jails were there because they couldn't make bail of up to $2,500. But criminal justice advocates worry that the new system may unfairly detain some defendants. With the previous cash bail system, defendants had the chance to get out, even if only theoretically. Their bail might have been a little high, but most people had the ability to go free before trial if they could scrape together enough money. Now,
you're detained until trial or you're otherwise released. There's no ability to get out, and therefore the stakes are higher, and we think correspondingly the protections need to be higher.
That's Alexander Shalom with the New Jersey ACLU. He wants to make sure judges have good reasons to confine somebody to jail for what could be months before a trial. And the rules for detention hearings, where defendants can argue against going to jail, have been changing since January. For example, defendants are now entitled to see more of the evidence against them before going in front of a judge. But the other major factor influencing judges' decisions and another major change to the criminal justice system is a computer algorithm. It's called the Public Safety Assessment, and it's a computer-generated score assigned to defendants to show how risky it would be to release them from jail. Here's what it sounds like in a real-life courtroom. This New Jersey judge references the Public Safety Assessment before deciding to release a man before trial.
The Public Safety Assessment literally could not be lower in the scores. It's literally the minimum. And I am going to release Mr. Patterson with the condition of monthly reporting. There are some additional conditions. I am going to...
But not all defendants are so lucky. Here's the same judge noting a different defendant's criminal history and his likelihood to skip court.
So the court is going to grant the application, and Mr. Fisher will be detained pre-trial.
In January and February, about 900 defendants across the state were confined to jail before their trials. But for the 5,000 who were released, what happens to them? The lowest level offenders are just let go. A majority of defendants have to check in periodically with a case officer in the state's new pretrial services division. And a few have to wear a GPS monitoring bracelet so officials can track their location. Judge Grant says the courts have not collected data on the extent to which defendants are complying with the rules of release. But he's heard that people are eager for the second chance.
I will tell you a little anecdotal comment we got. Some people were calling in weekly when they weren't obligated to call in weekly because they wanted to tell the staff how well they're doing while out on release.
Critics of bail reform, especially those in the bail bonds industry, say it's only a matter of time before a defendant out on release commits a major crime. And officials in the courts concede this is bound to happen too. They just hope that public perception doesn't turn on the new system when it does. For Here and Now, I'm Joe Hernandez.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. The Dow dropped more than 150 points after the opening bell this morning, putting the index on track for its longest losing streak since 2011. Investors are pointing the finger at the demise of the Republican health care overhaul bill on Friday. They're worried about whether the president will be able to push through other priorities like tax reform. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's in New York. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And tell us first about more of what we're seeing in the markets today.
Well, you know, as you said, we started a pretty dismal day on the downside, and that follows last week. Now, last week we were down about 1.5% in the large stock indexes. It was actually the biggest weekly loss for the S&P 500 since the week before the election. Now we're adding on it today. Hey, look, we could claw back and end up higher on the at the end of the day. But I think this is a direct impact of the health care repeal and replace being scrubbed at the last second. This is calling into question what other priorities might face similar demises in the future.
When we mentioned tax reform, that's the one that the White House seems to say is up next for the president. What exactly is being proposed on tax reform?
Well, we don't have a formal, you know, something to really look at yet. But what we can do is we can look at President Trump's plan when he was a candidate. And in that plan, he would reduce the number of tax brackets down to three, a 12%, a 25%, a 33%. And he also called for a higher standard deduction. He would eliminate certain filing statuses, might cap itemized deductions, limiting exemptions. So all of this would be really a very big change from what we have right now. And again, this is just the Trump plan. There's a whole separate plan that the Republicans had. They put it out last summer.
And what about the criticism of the president's ideas on tax reform, that they would benefit the rich and not the middle class?
Well, you know, we have the benefit of having the Tax Policy Center, which is that joint venture between Urban Institute and Brookings Institution. And when it looked at the Trump proposed plan, the highest income taxpayers, now I'm talking about the super tippy top, the 0.1% of the population. If you make more than $3.7 million, you're in that category. You would get an average tax cut of over 14% of your after-tax income. For all of us regular schlubs in the middle fifth of the income distribution, we would get a tax cut of 1.8% of after-tax income. So that's a huge differential.
And it's going to bring up the same questions that arose when the Bush tax cuts went through, which is, do they really pay for themselves by growing the economy so that they don't just add to the debt?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of the Bush tax cuts, and we're talking about two separate ones, 2001 and 2003, the evidence just isn't there. We would have thought they might have a larger impact on economic growth. I think the first one was really a hodgepodge of different types of cuts. The second one is actually sort of the supply side case for this, and it just didn't really do as much. And frankly, the statistics on the income and employment growth, it just doesn't show a lot of evidence that those particular tax cuts had a big impact on economic growth.
So what might happen in the few seconds we have left?
Oh, gosh. It is going to be crazy. Just remember, in tax policy, there's always a winner, there is a loser, and there's a lobbyist on each side. This is going to be a long and thorny battle.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Thanks so much, as always.
Take care.
Whether you love or hate the Affordable Care Act, it was designed to try to improve our healthcare system, which is uneven, expensive, and complicated. It's a system that evolved over a long time, and according to historian Nancy Toms, the problems with it are not new. Nancy Toms joins us now from her office. She's a professor of history at Stony Brook University and author of the book Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. And this month, she won the Bancroft Prize in American History and Diplomacy. Nancy Toms, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me start with this question. How did we get where we are in the healthcare system as it is?
Well, as a historian, I have to say this is not a train wreck that has just developed in the last years since the passage of Obamacare. We have a long and very troubled history in trying to arrive at what other democracies have arrived at, and that is a sense of full coverage for all citizens.
And we've gone in a totally different direction than other countries, which is that they've gone with universal coverage in many cases provided by the government and taxpayers, and we went a different way.
Yes. And decisions that were made as early as World War I, we are now seeing the consequences today. The United States turned its face away from the idea of government involvement in provision of health insurance starting in World War I, we developed a very robust system of private insurance, but that was only for people with high-end jobs. So union workers negotiated and got more coverage in the 1950s. Executives started getting private health insurance as part of their employment package. So insurance became more available, but at a high cost that left a lot of people out, and we're still trying to figure out how to get the lost ones into the fold.
And before there were programs like Medicare and Medicaid, people who couldn't afford that insurance or didn't have a job that was good enough to provide it would just have nothing.
Precisely. Or charity. And one thing that Americans have long been averse to is the idea of charity, of being on the dole. So one of the drives behind creating Medicare was to create a program that would take that stigma away. You would be saving in advance, you'd be paying into a system over the course of your lifetime and then reap the benefits when you needed it.
And at the time that those programs came about, Medicare and Medicaid, why didn't the government just cover everyone? What was the argument? Or was there a major debate about whether it should just be one big universal health care program?
Yes. And the decision was not to go that route because There is a longstanding belief that private is better than public. You only resort to public if you can't get the private to do it. The idea of insuring elderly people who just at the point when they were likely to need more medical care, or very poor people who would present all kinds of health problems, they're just not an attractive population for private insurers. They never have been. They still aren't now. And that indeed is a big part of what we're struggling with at this very moment.
How far back in time do you have to get to a point where there is no insurance company and you just deal with your doctor directly and pay for the service that you get?
That would be 1935.
And was that system unsustainable? Could you not have continued on a system without insurance companies?
It was, in the sense that as healthcare got more technologically sophisticated, when you went to the hospital, you were having x-rays, you might be having surgery, procedures that were far more expensive.
Right.
That it would be difficult. Essentially, the expansion of hospital care was being limited by the fact that few people had sufficient savings to cover a major medical incident. And even though old line doctors who hated all forms of insurance, they believed if you put a third party between themselves and patients, bad things were going to happen. In some ways, they were absolutely correct about that. But the problem was people couldn't afford the care. The hospital couldn't get the debts paid. Medical debt collecting is a very early specialty in the United States. Far better than a system, a private system like that, where the patient is left with debts they can't pay or it takes a lifetime to pay back. Far better to set up an insurance program that will save money over time, and then it's there when they need it.
It seems like, among other things, one of the big consequences of the system that we have today is that patients have to do a lot more of the work themselves. They've got to decide what insurance plan they want, and they have to take control of it themselves. Is that right?
Absolutely. The way the American system has been constructed, it requires patients to do more than their counterparts in other countries. Just this morning, I was speaking to a group of physicians in the Netherlands, and they simply cannot wrap their heads around the concept of the patient as shopper. That is simply not a concept that you're going to find in a nation like that. When I said, well, in the United States, healthcare is not considered a basic human right, they just looked at me as if I had sprouted horns.
Well, and it's not just that the patient has to shop for insurance, but also often they have to get on the phone and argue for the benefits that they're being promised and potentially being denied by the insurance company.
Yes, and their physicians often end up having to do that on their behalf as well. I hear from physicians all the time that they spend a huge amount of their very specialized labor calling up insurance companies, pharmacy benefit managers, in order to get a patient permission to get a treatment that both the patient and the doctor want.
So as you have looked at where we've come from, where we've gotten to in healthcare in this country, is there anything beneficial about our system compared to other systems around the world?
We've paid a price for the trade-offs that we've accepted over the decades. Are there areas in which American healthcare provides a superior level of technical care? I think that's absolutely true. But you have to set that up against the dysfunction of the rest of the system. It is so uneven. It's so disorganized. You have to work so hard to get the right care that it's a trade-off. So I would say, yes, in some ways, there are clearly things that we can do well. But when you look at the dollars that we spend and the outcomes we get, we clearly don't have it right.
So is there a way to get it right? Is this system fixable, or does it need to be ripped up and started all over again?
Theoretically, I would say it needs to be ripped up and started all over again. Practically, one thing historians learn to respect a great deal is the importance of past choices and how they determine present choices. The strength of the system that we have in place, we have invested in it for so many years, that completely knocking it down and setting up, say, a single-payer system, I personally, much as I think of that would be a good solution to our problems, I don't believe it will ever, ever happen. The commitment to private insurance and the political strength of the insurance industry is such, I don't believe that will ever, ever happen.
That's Nancy Toms, a professor of history at Stony Brook University and the author of the book Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy Toms, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And before we go to break, we want to note the passing of Clem Curtis, probably not a household name, but the voice behind a song you probably have heard. He was the singer of Baby Now That I Found You with the Foundations. Clem Curtis was 76 years old. You're listening to Here and Now.
There's a good chance at least some of you are holding on to the style section of the Sunday New York Times to linger over the wedding announcements. The couple met while playing cricket. Mr. Whitney and Ms. Edwards both graduated from Yale. She's a Wall Street investment banker. He's developing water sources for third world countries and is a member of the Olympic rowing team. Or words to that effect. The ladies on Sex and the City read them.
And Sunday is the one day a week you get the single woman sports pages, the New York Times wedding section.
This is so depressing. The oldest woman on this page is 27.
I don't want to hear that. Now I'm all depressed and I haven't even had my coffee yet.
They are the wedding announcements people love to hate. There was a 2009 book parody. But now with social media, everyone can join in, and they are. Steve Bell is a senior staff writer at the New York Times who works with Society and Metro News. His recent column was, "Like to Mock Our Wedding Pages? Get in Line." And Steve, the section recently issued a correction that drew a huge response. This is telling. Don't talk about the specific people, but give us a sense of what the correction was.
We had made sort of a boneheaded mistake where we had said that the bride's engagement ring had seven stones, one yellow sapphire, two blue sapphires, and six diamonds. Well, that obviously adds up to nine, so some professor wrote in and said, am I missing something? How do one, two, and six add up to seven? So we probably shouldn't have, but we decided to go ahead and run a correction and say the bride's engagement ring had nine stones, not seven. Well, social media lit up with people assuming that the bride was upset that we had shortchanged her on the number of stones in her engagement ring. And
this is the point, that it just is off-putting to people who would think that, hey, seven is fine, you know. look, here's a tweet from comedian Selena Kapa. Here she wrote on September 9th, the groom is a Mayflower descendant and was educated at Eton College and the University of Oxford. Bow down, you filthy plebeians. Is that the sense that people have, that these lives are almost too rarefied air?
They do. But we've been trying to make the announcements much more inclusive. In January, we ran a piece on a couple that was married at the Manhattan Marriage Bureau, and the bride's dress cost all of $6. But those don't get noticed. To some extent, it's governed by what people expect when they submit the announcements. I think some people think they have to have a Mayflower ancestor or be a Harvard graduate to get in, and that's not the case.
Well, and there are some who are many of those things. Mayflower descendant, who wouldn't think of mentioning that in their wedding announcement? There's that too. Like, what does that have to do with betrothal?
When I joined the wedding staff 4 years ago, I was surprised to find guidance on how to determine whether to include somebody as has a Mayflower ancestor or not. But it's something that people are proud of, and we include that as we include other notable achievements that someone in the family might have.
Well, you write about videos that have been made over the years, commentaries, parodies. Gina Friedman has videos. Then there's Zach Miller's Veiled Conceit blog. There's another 2015 post you write about, L.V. Krauss, Why I Hate the New York Times Wedding Announcements. It was in the Thought Catalog website.
That was a very good one.
She writes, they trembled. In what parallel universe do people tremble upon first meeting each other? In the New York Times wedding announcement parallel universe, that's where. There's never an announcement that reads, Ryan and Brooke finally got sick of hookups and they figured they'd better kick out some kids before they got too old to get up with them in the middle of the night without badly affecting their quality time. But as you say, you might feature Ryan and Brooke.
We might. We encourage anybody to submit.
But how do you decide?
It's made partly on the basis of achievement, but we also choose on the basis of whether the couple is interesting. We've got our small announcements, and then we've got the weekly vows column, which goes into a love story at more depth. And those are chosen pretty much on the basis of who has the most interesting story to tell.
Yeah. You've also had historic moments, gay and lesbian wedding announcements. Mm-hmm. I love the older people, you know, who maybe they were high school sweethearts and they're getting married at 70.
We've got one coming up, a couple that is getting married after being together for 25 years.
Very sweet. But, you know, it is a love-hate. I mean, they may be mocking what you guys do there, Steve Bell, but they're reading it.
Right, right. That's the important thing. I mean, some of the critiques and the satires and the parodies get a little mean-spirited, but I don't worry about it too much because the important thing is that they're reading, and so that's what we're looking for.
Yeah. Well, it's just as the author of Weddings of the Times, that book that parodied the celebrations, wrote, the wedding announcements are so perfect and polished. The inspiration comes from that sort of primal feeling one gets when one sees a picture and wants to scribble a mustache on it.
That's right.
We wish them all well, all the couples. Steve Bell, senior staff editor at The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.